Somebody stole my sunshine. My sunshine has been stolen. It's a miserable Sunday. It's a miserable Sunday morning. It's the 28th of May 2017. It's just after 11 a.m. UK time. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening to Sunday View, or thanks for joining me for Sunday View anyway. I'll be looking at the front pages of the UK tabloids and broadsheet newspapers over the course of the next 60 minutes or thereabouts. As always, you are welcome to join in. To join in, you just have to tweet at Richie Allen Show. Tweet me, tell me what you're thinking this pretty miserable old Sunday, although we've been spoiled, haven't we, over the last few days. Sunday View begins right now.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England, this is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com.
And I'm Richie Allen. Good morning. Good morning. As I said, tweet at Richie Allen Show right now. Looking at the front pages of the Sunday newspapers, dominated, of course, by the attack at the Manchester Arena last Monday, which killed 22 people. So there are developments there. We'll talk about those as well. Well, the main television political talk shows are on as I speak. I've been recording some of those for you as well. I'll bring you some of the interviews from there and we'll have a conversation, you and I. The email is open as well. It's richie@richieallen.co.uk. This is Sunday View and it's broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and of course richieallen.co.uk. Do bookmark davidicke.com/headlines because what I talk about today is covered in great detail, great analytical detail on davidicke.com/headlines. Let's get rid of the dramatic music. I thought you might like a bit of dramatic music there. Do you like it? Chicago Bulls, I believe. Right. Yeah. Right, it's been a decent old weekend. Watched the cup final yesterday. I don't think it was the greatest cup final of all time, but I chilled out, watched the old cup final tradition. Not so much in my household, but tradition in my life, I always watched the cup final. And I've just been relaxing, really, and chilling out. Didn't go anywhere near the city centre. You'll probably know that there were street games taking place in Manchester yesterday. And today, there's a big run. There's a run on there of some sorts, a professional run. And, you know, a lot of people taking part as well, working for charities. Can't bear, really, to go anywhere near the city with all the memorials and wreaths and all of that public outpouring of grief, which I don't have any time for. And I've been called hard for that. You're a hard bastard, Richie. You're hard and you're unsympathetic. It's not the case at all. And I'm not going to explain it because I've said so many times before how I feel about these things. Anyway, thanks for joining me. I already said that, but I'm going to say thank you again. And feel free to tweet me right now. It's at Richie Allen Show. That's the Twitter handle. Of course, I'll make time for your tweets. I'll read them out as they come in. Let's have a look at the newspapers then. Let me just scroll back up there. I've lost the run of myself. The newspapers, yeah. That being said, before I get into the newspapers, I think most of the media have left the city. The trucks and the outside broadcast units, I think they've gone now. And I think the primetime anchors, yes, drop the W, have left the city. Good riddance, I think, to all of those people. But as you'd expect, the papers are full of it today. Let's have a look at the front pages. The Sunday Mail headline. The headline is, "The Casual Killer on His Way to Mass Murder." So the Mail, like many newspapers today, is carrying a picture of Salman Abedi, which was allegedly taken while he was on his way to the arena. Now, the police released the images and they were taken from CCTV grabs. That is what we are told. It's hard to tell where in the city they were taken. He has a black jacket on and a baseball cap. He's wearing glasses. The device is presumably under his jacket. Now, I say presumably because as far as I'm concerned and the programme is concerned, everything is allegedly. So allegedly, this is Salman Abedi on his way to blow up 22 people at the arena. That's the Sunday Mail. Now, the Star on Sunday has the same picture. The headline is Evil on His Mind. Evil on His Mind. The Sunday Mirror, the same picture. The headline is Moments Before Massacre. So we're talking minutes before he walked into the foyer of the Manchester Arena. That's what the tabloids are saying about the story today. They've published a picture. And I can see by my Twitter feed that a number of you have tweeted it and retweeted it, and a number of you are not happy with the picture and you've got questions. And I have no problem with any of that. I don't deny you your right to do that. I don't know, you see. And one of the things that I think we've lost the ability to do, and I say we, I mean people whom are innately suspicious of the establishment and of the security services. Sadly, we've lost the ability to say, I don't know, or, well, it's possible. We seem these days to start from a predetermined position, which isn't helpful, not for us personally, and not for the search for truth anyway. I don't believe we should start even from a predetermined position, even the predetermined position that this was some sort of false flag. Now, I happen to think that the murder of those 22 people last Monday, dreadful, dreadful thing. Again, imagine having to come to terms with it. I happen to think that agencies of the deep state might have been, probably were behind it. But I don't start out from that position. That's not the predetermination. We shouldn't do that. Have a look at everything. Keep your eyes and ears open. Just be a bit more clever about what you say. For your own credibility, I think. You know, if I can impart a little bit of advice, how dare I give anybody any advice? But that's the way I do this programme. Look at everything. Don't jump to any conclusions. See what's happening. So anyway, those are the tabloid front pages. Picture of Salman Abedi and the caption, basically, moments before massacre, evil on his mind, just before he did it. Now, before we look at the broadsheet, Sky News are running an exclusive today with a man called Abdullah Muhsin Norris. I hope I didn't pronounce that wrong. In fact, I might pop around and have a word with the guy because he's only about a mile away from me. Abdullah Muhsin Norris. Now, he's the chairman of the Salam Community Centre in Moss Side, which, as I said, is a mile away from me. I know the community centre. I've passed it before. Now, he said, did Abdullah Muhsin Norris, that he has a problem, or that he had a problem, with the alleged bomber Salman Abedi. 2 months ago, Salman Abedi attempted to stay in the mosque overnight, and he became a minor nuisance to Abdullah Muhsin Norris, who spoke with Sky News. Sky News are calling this their big exclusive. Have a listen to a little bit of it. It's interesting.
I saw him staying over in the mosque, and I told him that he had to leave, right? And that was the first incident. Another incident...
Why would he stay over?
I think he was here probably from Fajr, from early morning prior. He stayed behind while everybody had gone, because some people like to stay and wait and pray just before the sun rise, right? And because you get a lot of blessing for doing that. So they would stay and pray, and then after that, they would go home and go to school or work or wherever they're going to go. So I think he was one of them that stayed behind, but he stayed after, because I normally come here between 10 and 11.
And in the evening?
In the morning. In the morning. And then when I came, I heard somebody coming, you know, flushing the toilet. So when I went to look, it was him. And he's got on his trainers. And I was very annoyed about it, because you can't come from the toilet and walking on the mats where we're going to do wudu, and then from there we're going to come to the mosque to pray. So I was very, very annoyed with him. He said, don't treat him as a child. I said, you're a child. If he wasn't a child, you know, would not behave like that, because you should know better. You know? And that was my last confrontation with him.
And that's the last point that you can remember him being here?
That was the last point that I spoke to him.
Yeah, now, any journalist worth his or her salt would have to have some pretty serious questions about the story we've been told so far about Salman Abedi and about the events leading up to the bombing at the arena last week. He sounds pretty immature, doesn't he, and scatty, according to the chairman there of the mosque. And this is only 2 months ago, remember. Doesn't sound like a hardened radical jihadi. Almost sounds immature, sounds a bit childlike. You know, wearing his trainers, walking across the mosque there to pray, coming out of the toilet, trying to hang around the building and trying to stay there overnight, even though we were told that he sublet an apartment in the city centre. It doesn't add up. Now, I know it's only a small thing, but when you add all the other things that are a bit strange, it gets a bit worrying, doesn't it? And then, of course, he headed off to Libya and presumably went to Syria for a bit and then came back here and blew himself up, right? So anyway, the Sky presenter asks the chairman about how he goes about helping to prevent against radicalization.
Well, we do talk to them about it. And I put a notice up on my door. That door there is a notice there, right? Where I'm telling people that I don't want anyone to be staying in the mosque after we have prayed, because I don't know what conversation they'll be having. So I don't want to entertain them. And I said no one to come to priest politics likewise.
But is a sign on a door enough?
No, it's not enough, but it rose suspicion. Brothers asked me why you put it up. I said I'm putting it up because I don't want anyone to stay here to, you know, to be doing anything concerning terrorism or anything like that. I don't want anything to be in Salah Masjid.
Are you doing enough to prevent atrocities? Because this man went on to commit an atrocity.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you had no way of necessarily telling that.
No.
But do you feel that you do enough to highlight people that you believe may be having those conversations?
I don't think you can ever do enough. You have to keep trying.
But what conversations exactly? The presenter or the journalist, the reporter at the mosque is not being specific, really. What sort of conversations exactly would a imam or a, you know, maybe somebody who calls to prayer, what sort of conversations exactly would they be concerned about? What exactly would young men be talking about that would lead them to be reported? You see, none of this is pursued by the reporter. He's after a couple of quick sound bites. It's all about a narrative. I'll tell you more about it in a minute.
Because sometimes when you talk to people, it's just like it comes through one ears and it goes to the other. So in our khutbas and so on, we're encouraging our imams to keep talking about it, right? So that our youths don't take up that line.
Do you share things with Greater Manchester Police?
Well, at one time, I used to be on the police forum when they were having meetings and so on. We used to go, but that had stopped for a long while. But I have police officers coming and we sit and talk. Up to a couple of days ago, we was talking to... No, twice this week, we were talking with the police, you know? And if anything like that is going on and I realise it, I'll be the first one to report them.
And I think what all of this does is to cement the acceptance of the narrative, right? Planting seeds in people's minds to accept that otherwise decent young men are being radicalised by watching Islamic State videos and Islamic State propaganda online. Which, and I've been looking at this for many, many years, back to all the claims made about Al-Qaeda cells and sleeper cells. And I've concluded, remember, not starting from a predetermined position, but I've concluded, having read and read and read and studied and watched this for years, that it is monumental bollocks. As an idea, it is monumental bollocks as an idea. But it's gotten into our consciousness that we're in danger constantly because homegrown young men, not migrants, mind, we'll come back to that in a minute, not migrants, but their narrative is that homegrown young men, men born here, have been turned into mass murderers by videos, pamphlets and Twitter alone. I'm not having any of that. It's simplistic, right? It's backed up by no evidence whatsoever. In fact, the more I think about it, the evidence suggests to me that there is some sort of mind control going on here. You know, some of these young men, I believe, are being targeted, some of, by the very intelligence agencies that are supposed to be looking out for our best interests. And again, I'm going to suggest many of these agencies we've never even heard of. ISIS are not radicalizing men born and bred in this country. Because ISIS, perversely, are a creation of the same intelligence agencies, CIA, MI6 and Mossad. David did a brilliant video cast this week. And among the many things he covered in it was the reality of how ISIS, how these Wahhabi, Salafi, jihadists came to be in Syria. Who helped them get there? And he talked about the former French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, who spoke very directly on French television about how the security services of this country had decided to do something in Syria. ISIS are not radicalising people within the United Kingdom through tweets and through propaganda. They are not. I think I can say that with certainty. I probably shouldn't do that. You might say you're contradicting something you said earlier on. But that's what I've concluded. Now, I believe that, and I got into this with Kevin Barrett, we do have a cultural problem in this country with respect to how some and only some young Asian men behave. There's no doubt about that, in my mind. I think that's a serious issue. And not only should it be dealt with, but it has not been dealt with. It's deliberately not been dealt with. So among some young Asian men in this country, there is a problem. But not a radical, I'm going to blow you all up jihadi problem. A problem with how they see women, how they see themselves. And there are ways of dealing with that. And that's a separate issue from migrants coming out of countries that have been destroyed by Western intervention and some of the problems we've seen in Europe, in Germany and in Sweden because of that, which the far left won't acknowledge. And when anybody talks about it, they call them racist. And of course, the far right, the Tommy Robinson clowns, and I've spoken a lot about this, who just hate people anyway, full stop. Hate. They genuinely hate. You see, most of this PC stuff is very damaging because most people don't hate. Even people with negative stereotypes, who hold negative stereotypes about Asians or about Afro-Caribbeans or about Africans, deep down, most of these people are not endemically racist. We do have a problem in communities in this country. We have a problem with division. Where's the division come from? Some communities in this country, and I hear from people, I get emails from people living in these communities, where their local council is almost entirely made up of, or is entirely made up of, people from ethnic minorities. And what does that mean exactly? Well, it's led to feelings of isolation and fear among those who have seen their communities changed over the years. And some of those people, they don't express that fear very well. They're not articulate, not unintelligent. It's a huge difference. They're not unintelligent, but they're not articulate, maybe. And when they express their frustrations, they get labelled xenophobic and racist. And you know, you hear the politicians talk about integration and, you know, we're a multicultural country. There is no integration in this country. None. There never has been, and there was never meant to be. And this is not the fault of the Asian community. It is not the fault of Muslims or Sikhs or people who have come into this country from Somalia or from Eastern Europe. It's not their fault. 99% of these people, like 99% of Irish, English, Scottish or Welsh, just want to get along. They're as good or they are as bad as anybody else from any background. And this is the irony. We've been set against one another, right? It was long planned. The programme of culturalism is and was long planned, and it is a programme. Go to read some of David's books about that agenda. You know, the British Empire's destruction of, raping and pillaging of all of those countries was all part of a long, long, long-term agenda. And I was thinking, you know, a great friend of, somebody I've come to admire and respect and love in the city, is a great trade unionist called Michael Cohen, who's a neighbour of mine. Wonderful bloke, Michael. Sat in on one of the programmes about 2 or 3 months ago. You know that great trade union mantra, you know, the people united will never be divided. Well, it's actually working like this. The people divided will never be united. The people divided will never be united. We've been divided through multiculturalism. By tyrants who control us through banking, through the military-industrial complex, through wars of aggression, through Zionism. And rather than take them on, we're taking each other on. It was always meant to be, and that's why they flood countries with people fleeing for their lives from bombs that they themselves have dropped on those same countries. That's why they do it. Because they know that we will turn against one another. Always meant to be. And we fall for it. I'm sure, since the atrocity on Monday, I'm sure that some people in this city, maybe from, you know, maybe with a Pakistani background, with a Afghan background, I'm sure they've had abuse, verbal abuse. I'm sure they have. Because it works. This sort of thing works, you see. We don't discuss this enough. You know, we don't. Multiculturalism has failed. It has diluted sovereignty in countries, and it is not the fault of the brown-skinned guy living across the street. Him, his wife and his family are just as much victims of it as you. Anyway, going off on a tangent there. Bit of a rant there. My apologies. The Sunday People front page. My best pal died in attack. I'll be second mum to her girl. A woman who was there on Monday and saw her friend die has pledged to support the dead woman's daughter. That's the Sunday People. Incidentally, you'll remember Georgina Callender was the first named victim of the attack last week. Her family have been speaking over the weekend and they released another statement today. Sky News are on the story. Here's a brief report.
Georgina Callender was the first victim to be named after the deadly attack. The 18-year-old had been counting down the hours to the Ariana Grande concert.
So, so caring and loving, and she was just my best friend.
Now her grieving family has spoken out. In a statement released by Greater Manchester Police, they said her life was taken away after 18 short years by evil, evil men prepared to ruin lives and destroy families for what? Unless our government opens its eyes, we know we are only another in a long line of parents on a list that continues to grow.
There's thousands more waiting to do it, so I guarantee you, you'll be doing this again somewhere. That's a fact. Yeah, to some of the poor families.
Yeah, the Callender family there. I've had an email from... I think I'm pretty articulate as it happens, you know. I've had an email from Brian kind of ranting about my moving position on the bombing last Monday. My position hasn't changed. I have said that the anomalies around the attack, compared with other attacks, lead me to believe that the man involved, if he was involved, was more than likely a patsy or an unwilling or a coerced participant in the bombing by agencies of the deep state. What more do I have to say? That's what I think. I don't have any evidence to support that. I've only got historical evidence. The modus operandi of those who carry out these atrocities, in which most of the time people die. On some occasions, we've seen in the past, they've staged these things. We've seen that in Boston. We've seen that at Sandy Hook, I think. most of the time, people do die. And people have died here. What more do you want me to say on that? And think for yourself anyway. What difference does it make what I bloody well think? The Sunday Express, Theresa May, "My anguish" is the headline. The Prime Minister opens her heart to share her grief over murdered children. There's an interview in the Sunday Express. Caroline Wheeler interviewed Theresa May. May said, "Enough is enough," whatever that means. And she allegedly speaks movingly about the victims. The Sunday Telegraph, onto the broadsheets. "Minister, duplicitous social media firms failing to halt terror," is the headline. "Minister, duplicitous social media firms failing to halt terror." Ben Wallace is the security minister. He also used to work in counter-terrorism. Now he's an MP. Think about that one. He's saying massive internet firms' encryption allows jihadist videos and recruitment and radicalization. It has to be stopped, he says. And he wants the big internet firms to spend billions to take down harmful content. Again, this narrative, which is untenable. It's untenable that young men living in the UK, born and bred here, were doing fine, thank you very much, ma'am, until they saw an ISIS video online. Then they turned into a murderer. No, it doesn't happen like that. It doesn't. There's no evidence to support that. Theresa May is also saying today that teachers, wait for it, must also teach pluralistic British values. What does that mean? It means rubber stamping, multiculturalism and coexisting. Teach children about the inevitability of a world with sovereign states gone. With sovereign states a thing of the past. Everybody living side by side, no matter what their views are, in tolerance. It sounds brilliant, that, doesn't it? It sounds the right thing. Yes, why shouldn't we all live together? Completely tolerant of one another's views. You know, so long as people are not doing anybody else any harm, we should, of course, be completely tolerant of one another. But it's not about that. It's not about that. Because they don't want that. This crazy, totalitarian, evil, sick system does not want us living alongside one another, getting on with one another. Because if we were to do that, we would collectively see the problem. And we would do something about it. So this is how they sell it. Let's teach pluralistic values. Now, the Home... I've got to take a break. We're going to hear from the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, in a minute. She was on the Andrew Marr show, as was Diane Abbott, her shadow counterpart. We'll hear from both of them in a minute. Two different interviews. Two decidedly different interviews. But before we get there, let's have a very quick break. This is Sunday View on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, and richieallen.co.uk. Back in 60 seconds.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Welcome back. This is Sunday View, and it's exactly 29 minutes past the hour. You're with me, Richie Allen. Keep the tweets coming in at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Let me read a few of them. Mark tweets, "Saudi Arabia has a lot to do with it all over the world with these terrorists." Yes, Hubert is responding to that. "Saudi Arabia created by the UK, armed by the US and the UK. Catherine tweets, "The problem is the Quran doesn't allow integration with non-Muslims. I replied, the Old Testament is littered with passages promoting violence, murder and torture. It really is. Kate Coley tweets, May is more interested in her shoes than murdered children. Diane tweets, a lot depends. Oh, there's a bit of a discussion there about another programme. Hi to Jay Ferguson. Hi to Tiger, who says, when does a child learn to celebrate the difference in cultures? Children copy the action of adults. Let's connect the dots, says Tiger. Hi to Mazaroth as well, to Spirit Samba. Let me scroll on down there. A lot of tweets coming in as well. Hi, Jim. My great friend and colleague Hayden Hewitt is tweeting about some of these issues this morning on Twitter. Pat Garrett, how you doing, Pat? Richie, do we know whether the bomb was detonated by the alleged bomber or was it detonated remotely? Regards, Pat. Pat, I haven't a clue. Is the absolute truth. I have no idea whether the alleged bomber set it off himself or whether it was set off remotely. I haven't the foggiest idea. I really don't. Yeah, so there you are. Let's move on, eh? Keep the tweets coming in. It is always good to hear from you. Now, the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, she's responsible for security on the mainland. And her shadow counterpart, Diane Abbott, both of them were with Andrew Marr on the BBC earlier today. We're going to hear from Amber Rudd first, as she's the current Home Secretary, Amber Rudd. Andrew Marr asks her, first of all, if there are still jihadis connected to the Manchester attack at large. Are there still jihadis in Manchester running around?
Potentially. I mean, it's an ongoing operation. There are 11 people in custody. There's the operation is still at really at full tilt in a way. And so until the operation is complete, we can't be entirely sure that it's closed.
Right. There might be, we don't know, says Amber Rudd. I'm betting personally that most of those arrested, by the way, will be released without charge. Some of our Mancunian listeners will remember many years ago, raids happened in South Manchester. People were ripped out of their beds. They had the shit beaten out of them by the police and they were kept in prison for 2 or 3 weeks. Because they were believed to be part of a plot to blow up Old Trafford Football Stadium. Later on, they were all released without charge. Do you know why that is? Because there is not an embedded terror cell in Manchester. There isn't. It is a fantasy, a figment of the imagination of the establishment. It's not happening. Are there bad people in the city who could do bad things? Yes. Yes, and they wear many faces. But is there a terrorist cell working on behalf of ISIS in this great city and its surrounding areas plotting attacks? No, there are not. It is a fantasy. Now, he then asked Amber Rudd a very good question about jihadis coming back into the country.
OK, we were talking earlier on during the paper review about where Abedi had been, and we know that he's been to Libya. We think he may well have been to Syria. How many jihadis have come back from Syria to this country, do you think?
We don't know the exact number. What we do know is that in engaging with the intelligence services and with the police and with the border force, we make sure that they have the tools to track them and keep them out where we can.
Is it possible to tell where somebody has been when they come in? I mean, somebody comes through Heathrow, we don't know where they have been. They might have come in from Paris or Istanbul or wherever. How could we possibly know if they've been to Syria?
Well, it's all intelligence-led. And, you know, we have very good intelligence services who help to collect that information to make sure that we do, you know, follow and track the right people who might be dangerous.
Because the government has done one thing that could help you in this regard, which is to introduce temporary exclusion orders.
Yes.
How many of those have been used?
Well, I'm not going to give you the exact number, but I can say we have started to use them.
Because it was zero until recently.
It is no longer zero. It is part of the toolkit that a Home Secretary has so that we can keep people safe.
Now, Andrew Marr should have nailed her to the wall and asked her as many times as it took for her to tell him how many exclusion orders they have used in the last few days. okay? Because there are no national security issues here. Simple as this, love. How many people have you kicked out of the country in the last few days? I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to repeatedly ask you until you tell me. You are here as a representative of the people. You work for the people. I am one of 60 million taxpayers who pay your wages. How many of them have you excluded, love? Leave the love bit out of it. That wouldn't be nice. But you wouldn't answer anyway, right? And the truth is, Amber Rudd is deaf, dumb and blind. She has no idea because she genuinely has no idea whatsoever. We are led to believe, you and I, that the intelligence agencies answer to Amber Rudd. What a laugh. They don't. No chance. Rudd is like her boss, a front woman, to deliver the totalitarian agenda in a way that folks will accept it. They are so far down the trough, away from those who really make decisions, they can't even see them. They don't know anything. So what about blame then? How could it happen? With all the information on Salman Rabedi, with everything that was known about him, how could it happen last Monday? Andrew Marr, well, at least he asks that.
Now, clearly, as you said, the security services do a great job and all the rest of it. Nonetheless, there are questions that must be asked. Can I ask you how many times the security services were tipped off about Salman Abedi before he attacked?
Well, it's not for me to be drawn in on what the intelligence services did or didn't know, particularly at this stage, Andrew.
We do know some stuff about this.
We do, but the fact is this is an ongoing operation. The fact that you've already asked me are there other people that are going to be potentially pursued, that is because of the strong relationship between the intelligence services and the counter-terrorism policing. Of course, people will want to look afterwards to see whether there are signals that could have been learnt. How could we do this better?
Well, you see, this is the problem. Because when all is said and done and everything dies down, there will not be any interrogation by the media of people like Amber Rudd for an explanation as to how it happened. Again, Marr should respectfully nail her to the wall and say that is not good enough, it is untenable. I repeat, how could MI5 and counter-terror police have so much information about this man and yet have no idea of his whereabouts at 10:40 last Monday night, but Marr doesn't pursue it.
But can I also point out that...
No, you can't. I've asked you a question. How could they not have known where this guy was?
That since 2013, they have foiled 18 separate plots. They do a good job. We're not frightened, though, of learning lessons and improving.
I don't want in any way to diminish what they do. Nevertheless, what we do know is that Salman Abedi was identified as a dangerous man by friends and family, his community, doing exactly what we asked them to do. They phoned the terror hotline 5 years ago and then again last year. We know that the imam in his local mosque used the prevent strategy again to get in touch and say this guy is out of control, he's dangerous, and apparently nothing happened. Can I ask you directly, was Salman Abedi on a surveillance list?
I don't know those details that you've just said out to me because the intelligence services are still collecting information about him and about the people around him. But I wouldn't rush to conclusions, as you seem to be, that they've somehow missed something.
I'm simply saying that people had phoned the terror hotline, as they're told to
do. As they should do. And this, you know, the reason we've put in place the terror hotline, the reason we've put in place the prevent strategy is because we recognise the scale of the problem. What this reminds us, if we needed reminding, is the scale of the problem that we have.
What a failure. What a miserable failure of a presenter Andrew Marr has turned into again today. To not interrupt her and to demand that she account for how the intelligence agencies and the police, knowing so much about this guy through their cooperation with Europol and French intelligence, how he could land back in the country a few days only, not a week, but only a few days before detonating the bomb. How he could do that completely unmolested by the intelligence agencies. I'm sorry, Home Secretary, but I'm not letting you away with it. You're going to have to answer that. Well, there are still ongoing operations and it's unfair while the families... Don't bring up the families. Don't play emotional blackmail with me and my audience. The families are the ones who want this information. How could it have happened? But Marr doesn't do it. That's your media right there. You know? Rod knows nothing. And I'm going to repeat my take on it. If this guy did it, Salman Ramadan Abedi, the doors were opened to him to do it. Tell me I'm wrong. All the evidence that we have thus far supports the synopsis, the scenario, that this guy had doors opened to enable him to go and do what he did. Now, before Maher interviewed Amber Rudd, he interviewed Diane Abbott, who's the Shadow Home Secretary. For our overseas listeners who don't understand what that means, every government minister or government secretary has a shadow counterpart in the opposition party, in the main opposition party. So the Chancellor of the Exchequer will have a shadow Chancellor, which is John McDonnell, of course. It's Philip Hammond in the government, it's John McDonnell, right? Now, Diane Abbott, she's the Shadow Home Secretary. He didn't ask her about Manchester as such, strangely. Andrew Marr was determined to get into her terrorist-supporting past. I'm not saying that, by the way. Andrew Marr is. Have a listen to how this went down.
Shortly before 9/11, you voted against proscribing Al-Qaeda as an organisation. That was a huge mistake on your part, was it not?
Have you actually read the legislation we were voting on?
I have read the legislation and I've looked at the addendums as well.
And
I've got here.
What the legislation brought forward was a whole list of
organisations,
some of which some people would argue were not terrorist organisations, but dissident organisations. Well, and to say that because...
Okay.
Which
ones? Because I've got the list here. Al-Qaeda, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, the Armed Islamic Group, Harakat Mujahideen, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Group, Islamic Army of Aden, the Abu Nidal Organization, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Which of these should not be proscribed?
The titles are one thing, but the reality of some of those groups, whether they were dissidents in their country of origin, and that's why some of us were not willing. Had they taken out Al-Qaeda as one thing, that would have been something. But, you know,
this is a group of really dangerous organisations from all around the world, many of whom have killed a lot of people. Lashkar-e-Taiba carried out the 2008 Mumbai attacks, which killed more than 170 people. That was on the list. This was, no list is perfect, but it was a pretty good list, and you voted against proscribing those groups.
Because there were groups on that list which I deem to be dissidents rather than terror organisations. You have to give people credit for thinking about how they vote. As I said to you earlier, we're hearing about all this anti-terror legislation that Jeremy and I voted against, but we're not hearing that the Tories voted against some of the self-same legislation, particularly control orders and detention without trial.
Now, that was Diane Abbott there. She was against banning groups that were fighting despots. At the time, she was against internment and trial in secret. Now, I don't like Diane Abbott. I've no time for her. I've no time for any of them. But she's right in what she was saying. You know, I know my history. They were against putting people in prison without charging them with anything. She was against secret trials. She was against banning groups with exotic names who were, in fact, fighting, as I said, despots, fighting tyranny in their own country. But the BBC won't let it go. Andrew Marr won't let it go. So he then went after her about her opinions on the IRA.
You yourself said that it would be a defeat for the British state, would be a great liberation, a great move forward at that period of time. Do you regret your support for the IRA right back in the 80s?
That particular quote you're referring to comes from a now defunct left newspaper, and it had, as well as this...
But you said it, didn't you?
No, but what I'm saying to you is this. It was 34 years ago. I had a rather splendid afro at the time. I don't have the same hairstyle. And I don't have the same views. It is 34 years on. The hairstyle has gone, and some of the views have gone.
So you no longer... You regret the fact of what you said then about the IRA?
The hairstyle has gone, the views have gone. We've all moved on in 34 years, haven't you, Andrew?
We've all moved on. I'm just wondering, do you regret what you said about the IRA at the height of the bombing?
What specifically do you want me to regret?
Well, I can read the quote for you and find it here. basically what you said was that a defeat of the IRA would be devastating for the British people, and it was a defeat for the British state was a good thing, you said, at the time when the IRA was attacking the British state. And you said that the reason for the violence was entirely caused by the British presence in Northern Ireland. I'm saying, do you think those statements now are wrong?
But the British presence in Northern Ireland was, of course, the catalyst for the violence in Northern Ireland. And the third-class citizen lives that Catholics in the north of Ireland had to endure for decades was a catalyst for the violence in Northern Ireland. Dragging people out of their beds in the middle of the night and throwing them in prison for indeterminate time periods was a catalyst for the violence. These are the things that Diane Abbott and Corbyn and others were against back then. It was completely wrong. Speaking of despotic governments, the Thatcher government was despotic. Completely. A tyrannical government. Look at what it did to the miners in this country. The worst off. So they were right to stand up against it. They might have used language that might have been a bit regrettable, but so what? To be constantly beating them up over this stuff, you know. Have a listen to more of it.
It's now a wrong.
It was 34 years ago. I've moved on.
You've moved on. All right. I've got the quote here, finally. You said, the Ireland is our struggle. Every defeat of the British state is a victory for all of us. A defeat in Northern Ireland will be a defeat indeed, was the quote.
34 years ago, and I've moved on.
OK.
Yeah, good for her. She wasn't going to get drawn into it. But a defeat for them, a victory for Republicans in Ireland at the time, she could have phrased it better, would be a defeat for the British state. She could have phrased that better at the time. But it was a tyrannical state, right? Anyway, the final newspaper we'll look at is the Sunday Observer. Their front page headline is, "We need to deal with the European Union to combat terror, troops tell the Prime Minister." Now, I've been sharing my opinion with you that this was going to be a big story to come out of what happened in Manchester last week. They were going to equate difficult relationships between the European Union and the United Kingdom with terror. And a difficult relationship between the UK and the EU would allow terrorists to cross borders and get in because we wouldn't be sharing information. Europol wouldn't be telling us stuff. And we're in danger. We need to be closer to the European Union. So the former Chief Constable of the Police Service of Northern Ireland, a guy called Sir Hugh Ord, the former head of Europol, Max Peter Ratzel, they've all come together with Dominic Grieve, the former Attorney General, to say that our relationship with the European Union needs to be strong to combat terror, even if it means accepting European Union rules and judicial oversight for the European Court of Justice. Again, I did say this was coming. They were going to use these attacks and they were going to link them to the UK leaving the European Union because they will say, if we're not members, we'll miss out on crucial information that would otherwise help us to prevent attacks. Now, I'm not Nostradamus. It was easy to see this one coming down the line. And the Sunday Times leads with, on the front page, "Nervous Tories to relaunch May's campaign." The headline is that the story is the Conservatives made such a mess of their election manifesto and the launch of it that they're going to return to the party's core message that Theresa May is the best person to secure a good deal for the UK in the negotiations with the EU. And some polls today are saying that Corbyn is now only 5 points behind Theresa May in the polls. If those polls are correct, it means he's halved the deficit, or rather, the Tories allowed him back in the race with their dodgy manifesto. I'm going to take a very quick break when we come back. In fact, we won't quite take a break just yet. No, we won't. We'll stay with this because despite the polls indicating that Corbyn has clawed the lead back to single figures and only 5 points, according to some pollsters, he is getting hammered in the press again today for blaming the UK foreign policy for the attack on Monday, even though I don't think he said that at all. He said the war on terror has failed. We will take a break. I'm thinking on my feet here. We'll take a break when we come back. More on Jeremy Corbyn and the media reaction to his interview with the BBC's Andrew Neil on Friday.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbayerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Now, I mentioned before the break, Corbyn is getting mitred. He's getting mitred by the media over claims they say he made on Friday when he was talking about how the war on terror has failed and how our foreign policy has indirectly contributed to the sort of attack that we saw last week. Now, he went on another show. Andrew Neil is a journalist, allegedly works for the BBC, and he's conducting a series of interviews with the party leaders ahead of the election, which is imminent. It's only a couple of weeks away, on the 8th of June. Here's the start of Corbyn's interview with Andrew Neil. Neil jumps straight in with both feet. He jumps straight in on the issues of foreign policy and terrorism.
Mr. Corbyn, today you drew a link between terror attacks at home and British actions abroad. Do you believe if Britain had not followed the foreign policy it has since Tony Blair was in office, the attack on Manchester would not have happened?
The attack on Manchester was shocking, appalling, indefensible, wrong in every possible way. Parallel I was drawing this morning was that a number of people, ever since the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, have drawn attention to the links with foreign policy, including Boris Johnson in 2005, two former heads of MI5, and of course the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. And the point I was making was we have to make our streets secure, we have to make our population secure. We also, any sensible government has got to look to what is happening in Libya, a huge ungoverned space, and apparently a source of some awful extremism.
But was Manchester a consequence of our foreign policy?
Manchester was a consequence of one person going into a music event and killing a very large number of people. There can be no defence whatsoever of that.
So
and
nothing
I do not
to do with foreign
I do
policy?
Not in, I do not in any way change that view. That is just a vile, horrible event, and those people have got to be brought to book. One, obviously the one who did it is dead, but there appears to be a whole connection of them. I made the point that if we are to have a secure future, we've got to look at ungoverned spaces around the world and the consequences of our wars of intervention. This is not just me, as I said. It's MI5, it's the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, it's a number of other people.
Fair enough, you can't argue with any of that, but it didn't get any better. Neil carried on. He was determined to drive home the point that Neil was anyway. In his opinion, it's ludicrous to suggest that anything the UK has ever done overseas, none of that is relevant when it comes to what happened on Monday.
But I'm struggling to find the role of foreign policy. You see, Islamic State was founded well before the invasion of Iraq.
Lie number one. Massive lie by Andrew Neil. Massive, massive lie. And Corbyn doesn't pick him up on it. Staggeringly, Jeremy Corbyn does not pick him up on this. Listen again.
But I'm struggling to find the role of foreign policy. You see, Islamic State was founded well before the invasion of Iraq.
Wow. Right? Don't need to labour that point. Let's hear what else he says.
It's murdering people across Europe because it hates our values.
Oh my God, they hate our values. They hate our way of life. They hate our freedoms. That's what they hate.
Only last year they said this. Some might argue that your foreign policies are what drives our hatred. But this particular reason for hating you is secondary. Even if you were to stop bombing us.
That was handy, wasn't it? Wasn't it handy that somebody found an ISIS pamphlet where ISIS says, actually, your foreign policy doesn't really bother us. It's not that that we hate. It's your freedoms. That was handy, wasn't it? Wasn't it handy that ISIS said that? Oh, Jesus Christ.
We would continue to hate you. Our primary reason for hating you will not cease to exist until you embrace Islam.
So ISIS's policy on our policy and on why it hates us sounds like it was written by a child. And Andrew Neil believes it. Jeremy, by the way, is sitting there. He's not got very much to say.
They have, it's not foreign it's policy. It's totally perverted for Islam. It's not Islam at all.
But it's not foreign policy.
No, it's not Islam at all. What we have is a total perversion of Islam there. The point I'm making, and the point that many others have made, not of necessarily Labour opinion or any other, quite a wide range of opinion across the spectrum, is that you have the consequences of our interventions in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, leaving large numbers of ungoverned spaces, leaving people in a desperate situation who themselves may become prey to that form of perversion. And I think it would be unwise of any government to ignore that. And that is exactly what the Foreign Affairs Select Committee pointed out.
But they're targeting young girls at a pop concert because they hate our values. They said they hate secular liberal societies. It's not foreign policy.
We're supposed to believe, you see, and I talked at the very beginning of this programme about how the brainwashing of millions of people in Europe has led them to believe that men strap bombs on their chests or take guns into music venues only because they can't stand that we're having a good time. That's it. And that we get on with one another, and that we're secular. That's the reason. Out of nowhere, groups of men got together in the Middle East, and they went, Bruce Springsteen is on tour in Europe. What do you reckon, Hassan? Well, I can't fucking stand it, Abdul. I really can't. Look at him dancing and singing and everything. Give me a fucking suicide vest. Yeah, that's the way it works, you see. Imagine the levels of ignorance and apathy and brainwashing that people actually buy that. You know? Madness. And without resorting to swearing or shouting like me, Corbyn, if he really wanted to, could destroy Neil's argument. But he chooses not to.
I agree they hate those liberal values. They hate...
Ah! Stop, Jeremy! Stop the bullshit! Tell him! Expand on what you said 30 seconds ago about vacuums. Expand on that, Jeremy. Talk to him about Yemeni people pulling the bodies of their children from the remains of burned out buildings. Tell him that, Jeremy. Talk to him about the de-Ba'athification of Iraq after we ransacked, raided and destroyed Baghdad. Talk to him about the deliberate destabilisation so that these lunatics, most of whom who come from Saudi Arabia, could then be placed in these regions by the very intelligence agencies, Mossad, MI5, MI6, CIA, and so on. Tell him, Jeremy, that it's not an accident, it was deliberate to allow these people become who they are. These lunatic jihadists who put these videos on air of them butchering people and torturing people. Tell him, Jeremy. Tell him that it's a nonsense that people just decided to hate us because we gather together socially, because we have a pint, because we go and watch the football together, because women can wear short skirts. Tell him, Jeremy. Tell him it's bollocks, please.
They hate the idea of women being able to enjoy themselves.
Ah! No!
And all the liberal values, and that was the whole point of my speech this morning. We've got to defend our liberal values.
Sure, but where's the foreign policy? What was the foreign policy of Sweden that resulted in Sweden being attacked?
The foreign policy issue has to be for...
Jeremy, tell him that Sweden, like Germany and elsewhere, have had to deal with a massive influx of migrants as a result of the very interventions that you're talking about. And some of these young men won't be very nice. Tell him, Jeremy. Tell him.
For all of us, what is happening in a
but no.
number of countries where we have intervened and where there is a lack of any coherent form of...
But we'd be attacked anyway.
Well, Andrew, shouldn't we look at where the sources are coming from of those attacks?
And then if you listen to the entire interview, Andrew Neil gets into Yazidi women because Neil asked to move it away very quickly from a protracted and in-depth discussion about what this country continues to do within the borders of sovereign states. What is that? We kill, we injure, we maim, we destroy, we poison. We render millions of acres of land uninhabitable and unfarmable, dropping depleted uranium munitions. We are the cause of children being born with two heads, three arms. Don't know what that was. And all the other deformities we've talked about. I've had enough of this particular show. Tomorrow's a bank holiday. I'm not with you tomorrow. I'll be with you on Tuesday at 7 p.m. BST when Gilad Atzmon has got an outstanding new book out about identity politics. I'm going to be talking to Gilad about that and much more on Tuesday's programme. Listen, enjoy the rest of your Sunday, whatever it is you're going to do. The programme was produced, edited and introduced by me, Richie Allen. You and I will talk again on Tuesday at 7 p.m. Look after yourselves and one another. Until next time, it is bye from me. It is bye from me. Bye now.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com.